Hello, it's Peter Wright and Kathleen Beauvais with another exclusive episode for premium members of The Yakking Show. So if you're watching this in our general audience, you want to get the whole show, you've got to become a premium member. First off, let me introduce co-host Kathleen. Hi, Kathleen. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great, Peter. Thank you so much. And thank you also very much for tuning in. You know, we have interesting expert guests on this show, which we absolutely love. And today is absolutely no exception. We have the great privilege of welcoming back Dr. Michael Solomon. Dr. Michael Solomon is a professor of marketing and an expert on consumer behavior. He's also the author of the most widely read book on consumer behavior in the world, entitled Buying, Having, and Being. And if you haven't seen his initial interview, I would urge you to please go and watch that initial interview. I think you will find it incredibly interesting. And Peter, we will have that in that link in the comment section. Is that right?
Most definitely we will. Yep.
Well, welcome, Michael. How are you today?
Hi, Kathleen. Thanks so much for having me on again. It's great to see you both.
Well, now, Michael, you have a mantra, and the mantra is, we don't buy things because of what they do. We buy them because of what they mean. Can you please explain that to us?
Yeah, you know, that's kind of the gets to the heart of everything that I do. You know, the reason I went into this crazy field is that I'm fascinated by the idea that everyday objects have incredible significance in our lives. You know, it's not just the hugely expensive watch or sports car or something like that. Everyday objects play a huge role in defining to other people who we are, who we want to be, and also defining to ourselves. So really, a lot of what we look at in consumer behavior is trying to understand what we call the deep meanings of brands. And many of your listeners, you know, anyone who's trying to sell a product or service of any kind has a brand, or if you're an individual, you have your own personal brand. And, you know, I think the mistake that many companies make is they focus on the functionality rather than on the symbolic or emotional meaning of some of these products. And, you know, the reality is, fortunately, in many cases, certainly not all, but in many cases today, the likelihood is that most of the options you're looking at are probably going to work reasonably well. What differentiates one from the rest of the herd, I think, is the story behind it. And if you look at just about any brand category, and certainly in the B2C or business to consumer space, but B2B as well, you'll see that the brands that are the most successful are not the ones that just work well. Now, they all have to work, of course, but they go the extra yard because they're supplying you not only with functionality, but they're filling in part of the story of your life. And so when I say that people don't buy things because of what they mean, because of what they do, they buy them because of what they mean. I mean that literally. In that we're each of us is actively choosing brands, products, services, companies, ideas that become a part of who we are and how we present ourselves to others. So it's an incredibly important issue. And I can tell you, after 40 years of teaching MBAs and other marketing executives and so on, many of them just don't seem to get it because they want to focus on that technical differentiator. Rather than also thinking about what does your product or service actually mean to the people who consume it.
That is so true, isn't it? So just an extension of that one, how well does brand loyalty transfer from generations, from father to son, mother to daughter? Because I know of friends, for instance, who would buy a Ford pickup because their father had one and they grew up all their life with a Ford pickup and the family drove Ford pickups. So that seems to me to be stronger than anything Ford is going to do right now, right?
Probably, you know, if there's some kind of an emotional attachment, you know, which often can be nostalgia, right? Remembering riding in your grandfather in the old Ford truck or something like that. The only exception would be, ironically, can also just be out of habit, because for someone who's not very interested in the category, they're going to look for what we call heuristics or shortcuts to make the process a little less painful. And so one of those, we call it a rule of thumb. You know, a rule of thumb is buy what my parents bought. And you'll see this, for example, with college students. You know, I see this a lot when they're living on their own for the first time and they're setting up an apartment. God knows what that's going to look like. But if you go into the pantry, you know, my guess is often you'll find the same basic brands, you know, the sugar and the flour and so on, that was in their houses when they grew up. Right, so that's often a start. Now, that doesn't mean that Ford or one of these companies has a lock on you for life. The challenge is to understand the emotional story that Ford, for example, is telling.
Sure.
And perhaps tell another one that's more compelling in some way.
Mm-hmm.
But understanding that there is a story, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Sorry, Michael, Cassie. From a company standpoint, how would they go about attributing meaning to their product?
Well, if you've got a few hours, I can give you some answers. You know, I talk about this in my course on customer engagement. That's about 6 hours. There are many ways to do it. You know, the important thing is to recognize that you need to do it. And that's the first step that many companies haven't taken yet. But I like to think about it in terms of the very simple and basic model of engagement that advertisers have used for decades, and that's called the AIDA model, AIDA, which means awareness, interest, desire, and action. And it's just a simple reminder, and it's good for your audience maybe just to put, you know, make a little sketch of that. You don't sell a product immediately. When someone learns of the product, they're not going to learn of your product and immediately buy it in most cases. They're going to go through a process where they're going to become hopefully more and more engaged with different aspects of their minds. You know, at first it's just going to be simple novelty. Let's say, oh, that looks different. I wonder what that is. But if when you get to the point of purchase, it's often after what can be a fairly lengthy process of, you know, multiple touches with the customer. 5 to 7 is often a rule of thumb before they're going to buy anything. They have to become more invested in what you're doing. So again, it can't be just functionality. It has to be a story, and it has to be a story that resonates with something that's going on in their lives. And I have a lot of different examples of that. I even have a little audit on my website that people can download. Different routes to engagement. And if you look at successful companies, you know, the usual suspects like Starbucks and Lululemon and Nike and Apple and so on, each of those is taking a certain route to engagement at what we call resonance, where the brand really becomes a part of who you are. So it's understanding what aspect of that person perhaps you might mesh with. So, for example, I've done some work with CrossFit. You may be familiar with all those. Believe me, I didn't do CrossFit, as you can tell. But you know, all these guys, these men and women who are into this, and you know, the functionality there, I guess, is putting on big muscles, right? But the fact is that CrossFit is more like a sense of community, a sense of family, where the members encourage one another, et cetera. That's the basis of the CrossFit brand. So just as an example, you know, if you're trying to sell weightlifting equipment, you need to sell more than just how many pounds the barbell is. You need to sell the experience that people are going to have in perhaps altering their lives by losing weight or gaining muscle or doing all the other things we can do with products.
So just picking up on that one, Apple, one that comes to mind, they managed to get the desire stage very quickly, very often before the new iPhone is even on the market, right? You've got people wanting it before the thing is launched, before they know what it's going to cost. So they're really experts on that one. So, Michael, talk about your course a little more, your Engage course. I know we've both had a good look at it, and I think you've got it in 6 modules. Is that correct? Do you want to walk our audience through your course?
Well, sure. Yeah. It's, as I said, it's about 6 hours of content, but basically what I'm doing is taking about 50 years of research on consumer behavior, both academic research and also, you know, some proprietary research, and applying that to all of the different ways that we can try to ramp up engagement. And again, the actual course, the framework I use is that very basic AIDA model. And what I do is I walk the learner through the course. We start at the most superficial level of awareness, which is very important. No one's going to buy your product if they're not aware of it. But they're also not going to buy your product just because they're aware of it. And so as we make our way through the model, what I do is to show how along different dimensions, there are a variety of strategies and tactics that we can use that have been demonstrated to work. Many of them have been buried in the pages of journals for many years, but we know a lot about how people respond to offers and how they learn about brands, how they make decisions, the incredible impact of other people and of the culture that you live in, et cetera. There are many, many, many different factors that impact this. You know, I teach at the undergrad and graduate levels. I teach an entire semester course on consumer behavior. So we don't quite go into that detail, but what I tried to do is to take out the what does it matter to me questions and focus on those. So it's not like a long theoretical lecture by a professor. Don't panic. There is a little bit of background, but it's all with an eye toward, well, how can I apply this on Monday morning? And so by the time we reach the end of the course, hopefully we have created what I like to call brand fanatics. You know, people who are absolutely bonkers about a brand, again, not just because it does what it's supposed to do, that's a good thing, but because it plays an important role in telling us something about ourselves and how we express our identities in society.
So here's one that again occurred to me while you were talking. There's several product categories where the buyer is not necessarily the consumer. The one that immediately comes to mind is men's underwear. And I read somewhere that something like 60% of adult men's underwear is bought by their female partner, spouse, girlfriend, or whatever. That may or may not be correct, but a significant amount, and I know from several of my mates that they don't even know what brand of underwear they're getting because their wife sorts it out. So now we have yet another dimension to consider in marketing, and this applies very often to B2B marketing, where the decision maker and the buyer is not the consumer. So you not only have to motivate the consumer, or the wearer, in the case of underwear, you've got to motivate the person who's spending the money to buy it, right? So how do you address that one?
Well, you know, it's amazing that you mentioned that question, because I've actually back in the quite some time ago, I did a lot of writing on that topic, because it's incredibly important to understand that in so many decision situations, as you say, the end consumer is not really weighing the options the way we think of when you go to a store and you look at the options. And so I actually published an article in, 1987, I think it was, on what I call the surrogate consumer.
Okay. Yeah.
The surrogate consumer is someone who makes decisions on behalf of someone else. Now, when you think about it, that covers, you mentioned B2B, you know, but B2C as well. So, you know, anything from, well, obviously, let's say a physician who is making, you know, is deciding what drugs the patient's gonna take or the nurse. But expand that to other areas, and you'll see it's more common than you think. Stockbrokers, real estate agents, stylists, fashion stylists. I used to do a lot of work with professional wardrobe consultants. That was a big thing for a while.
Right.
And again, that's purely B2C. You know, these are people who pay someone else to come into their closet and literally, you know, strip out their closet and redo it. And I love that example because it shows you that these are usually quite important decisions that we're delegating. You know, your stockbroker is responsible for your retirement, you know, but you say, okay, you know, you're the expert, I will defer to you. And yet so few marketers have figured this out and have identified those intermediaries in the channel that I call surrogates and target messages to them in addition to or even rather than the end consumer, because typically the end consumer is going to, you know, the job of that intermediary is to be a curator, which is tremendously important today. That's what influencers do, by the way. Their job is to take our, what I tell my students that one of the biggest problems we face in a Western society today, ironically, is not that we don't have enough choices. It's that we have too many choices. People are overwhelmed with all those choices. And so anyone who has the ability to narrow them down and curate them and say to you, well, there's 1,000 that I looked at, but here's the 5 that I think are best for you. That is where there's value added in the channel. And so these surrogates are, Peter, are absolutely, you know, not only very important, but a lot of people don't think about them. So I'm really delighted you raised that question.
All right. Sorry, Kathleen, I'm going to just going to carry on this one. There's another angle to this as well. I don't know what you would call them. And that's particularly with stuff that's consumed by children that the parents pay for, but very often the children will influence them. So take breakfast cereals. You could have a breakfast cereal manufacturer that promotes how healthy the food is for the child. It's got all the vitamins. It's got this, it's got that. It's not going to give them tooth decay. But the kids likes it because it tastes good, or it has a toy in it, or whatever. So, you know, they could be promoting it to the parent, but the decision's made by the child for totally different reasons. Right? So there's another angle.
Yeah, absolutely. Again, both B2B, it's been more widely studied in B2B, but you know, where you have what's called a buying center, and a buying center is not a physical location. It's the group of people who are entrusted to make big decisions, you know, replacing the computer system or something like that. Now, when you dig into that, you realize that people in a buying center, and this is true for families as well, play different roles. You know, so one of the roles is called the gatekeeper, and that's the person who narrows down that information we were talking about. But there are influencers and deciders, you know, and so it could be. And I learned very early on in business that the most important person to get to know and to get on the good side of is the secretary to the CEO.
Yeah,
because they usually run the business, right? And so they are the gatekeeper. A lot of people don't understand that and will just try to barrel over those people because they think they're not part of the decision, and they're very, very wrong. And you know, do the same thing in families. You've got, you know, you mentioned breakfast cereals. Let's say you're in the travel business. I mean, an incredible amount of travel decisions are made by the children. Not by the, so if you're only targeting the adults, you're missing out on the main influencer.
That's right. And I'm glad you brought up secretaries, because I'm old enough to remember when secretaries were true gatekeepers. And I know that if you tried to ride over the secretary, not only did you risk not getting to the CEO, but you risk when you did get to him, the secretary was coming in after you and putting in a bad word about how rude you were. You didn't follow the rule. Oh, yeah. I've seen that happen a few times. So, yeah, very important. Kathleen, back to you.
Well, Michael, you already talked a little bit about the ADA model. So we're looking at awareness, interest, desire, and action. But I was wondering if maybe you could take us, I know you have a whole course on this, but perhaps you can give us you know, a little bit of an abbreviated version of each of those for us and some examples.
Yes, I guess I can do that. So let's start with awareness. What does it take to make someone become aware of you? You know, now if you, you know, think about, we're coming up here in the States on, you know, on a political season again, one just ended. You know, if you're a new candidate, if you're running for office and no one knows you, what's the most important thing strategically is just to build name recognition,
right?
Just to get people to become aware. Oh, I've seen that name on bumper stickers. Now, you may not know what that person stands for, but at least now they're kind of an entrant into the race, if you will. And so how can you, at that very basic level, what do you do to get noticed? And here we can, for example, focus on some of the very basic perceptual processes, the way our brains work to help us to distinguish some things from others using our senses, obviously our visual sense, But one very important thing is to remember that the visual channel is very, very crowded. Everybody thinks they're going to send their message visually, you know, with a clever ad or a beautiful presenter, whatever it is. And so, in the course, I do spend some time talking about what we call sensory marketing, which means using, in addition to vision, using the other senses to break through that clutter. For example, smells and textures and so on that help to give your brand, even at this basic level, a unique identity. And you see a number of brands ranging from a lot of hotels, for example, will have a signature scent. So no matter where you are in the world, if you're in X hotel, there will be part of that brand that is olfactory. And that is intended to remind you of where you are. So again, at that basic level, I'm kind of cherry picking a few examples. There are other things we talk about as well. But at that beginning level, you know, understanding how our brains function, just to what are some of the simple tricks we can do to make ourselves stand out in a crowded field. That's essential, especially when you realize that. And maybe I'm giving away the answer because I think I asked this in the course. But you know, when we think about how many commercial messages we're exposed to in a single day, the answer is close to 5,000. Mm-hmm. And people will say, "There's no way I've been in front of 5,000 messages." Well, maybe you haven't, but you probably have. It's just that you didn't notice 950 of them. So already those 4,950 messages are lost. Money is wasted. So again, at that basic level, you know, getting yourself noticed in some way, you know, and then when you get to interest, how do you get people interested in something? Well, let's see. The basic determination we always make when we buy something is how much risk will be involved in buying this. There's always a risk associated with trying something new. As anybody who's tried to, you know, move a customer from one brand to theirs understands, we have a lot of built-in resistance there.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, anything that you can do to reduce risk, it might be financial risk, it may be social risk, like, will people laugh at me if I wear this? You know, so assuring people that the risk is far outweighed by the potential rewards of buying that product. And, you know, you can build interest in a lot of ways in terms of your messaging, of course. So, you know, one of the things I recommend in the course is to focus on what we call spectacles or guerrilla marketing, getting attention by doing something unexpected. You know, that's actually an extension of the awareness stage where you have to do something unexpected with your colors and your sounds and so on. But here you're doing maybe something unexpected behaviorally. You're doing a little, you know, if you know what guerrilla marketing is, it means to surprise people. It doesn't mean monkeys. It means the other kind, like guerrilla warfare, surprising people where they're not expecting you. And so doing some kind of, you know, having street art on the sidewalk that has your logo on it, or posters in public bathrooms and things like that. You know, there are many, many ways to do that. But you got to do something to jolt people out of there every day, because the thing is that we become so, you know, first of all, we're looking at our phones constantly. Mm-hmm. You know, at least my students are. And so we need jolts to just get us out of our reverie and look up and say, oh, that's interesting. That's different. I want to know more about that. You know, that just makes me curious. People want to be entertained. They want to learn things. And so that's one way that you can create interest. Excuse me. Desire, you know, that's where it starts to get interesting, because now you're starting to say that your brand, I desire it because it's something that I need or really want to tell a part of my life story. I'm working on some aspect of my life, and all of our lives are a work in progress, right? So we want to be a better spouse. We want to be a better employee, a better tennis player, whatever it is. And so to the extent that you can show the customer that your product is going to help them to achieve a goal that is central to them, that can be very, very powerful. And sometimes that means, for example, one of the things I talk about in the course, which isn't as obvious, I think, to most people, is linking your brand story to cultural events, to things, mm-hmm. important things that are going on in the culture. One obvious example is holidays, you know, like Christmas or Valentine's Day. And I don't have to tell you or your listeners, that's something that many marketers will latch onto, and for good reason. But sometimes we can heighten desire by taking a product that doesn't have that desire attached to it and linking it to something else, whether we, you know, a holiday or a myth like, say, St. Valentine. You know, what did St. Valentine do? Or sometimes we can be creative and invent an occasion. So I love to tell my students about Cinco de Mayo. You know, they get all excited mm-hmm. about Cinco de Mayo because it's an excuse to go out and drink a lot of tequila. but when I ask them, well, do you know why we're celebrating it? You know, usually they say, well, it was the day that Mexico got its independence or something like that. And I don't know if you know the answer.
I don't. But
the answer is nothing nearly as glamorous. It was some minor military battle that the Mexicans won. The Mexicans don't celebrate it. But this is my theory anyway. The alcohol industry people were looking at the calendar and they said, well, we have St. Patrick's Day in mid-March. And here in the States, we have Memorial Day weekend at the end of May, but we have nothing in the middle to promote alcohol sales. Let's find a date somewhat in the middle. Oh, May 5th.
Oh, that's a good one. Yeah.
And there are other stories about that. Sure. De Beers Diamonds basically invented the ritual of giving a diamond engagement ring.
Yep.
The companies that have invented practices that we are aware of, like giving out candy during trick-or-treating on Halloween, mm-hmm. that was started by a candy company. I mean, there are many examples of that. So you can really be creative by looking around you in your culture, in your society. Maybe there's a certain subculture that you focus on. What are things going on in that culture that you can connect your brand to? And basically, you're taking a shortcut to creating desire by hitchhiking a ride to an existing story.
And it then becomes sure. part of the culture.
Exactly. Yes.
Look how well the manufacturers of electric vehicles have hitched onto the whole climate change environmental thing, right?
Yeah, and that's a great example where, though, you know, if part of me is very green, you know, if that's very important to me, I'm going to look for products that are going to help me to build that project, right? And so obviously, you know, that's what the appeal of electric cars and recycling products, et cetera.
Yeah. That's it. They are very good. So then of course we move on to the action stage.
Yes. The good old action stage. I can't forget that. So, you know, at the act, you know, it's funny. A lot of marketers and retailers assume that once the consumer has finally made a decision about what to buy and where to buy it, that their job is done. But the reality mm-hmm. is that a lot can happen. You know, as I like to say, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. A lot of people will make a decision to buy something, but for various reasons, they won't go through with that. Maybe the product isn't in stock. Maybe they get a better offer on their way to the cash register. And of course, with our technology, we can do that, you know. Hey, not so mm-hmm. fast. I don't think you want that. This one's better. There's a lot of reasons, but you know, it can even be subtle environmental factors that influence us. And there's a lot of great research on this now. A lot of that falls under the rubric of behavioral economics. Maybe you've talked about it in other shows, nudging mm-hmm. and priming and giving yep. subtle hints in the environment about how to act. Incredibly powerful. And it can be something very, very subtle. I can, you know, if you want some examples, I can give them to you. But I talk about these in the course. Very, very subtle examples whereby by changing one aspect of the external environment where the person is considering products, for example, the temperature, even the texture of the floor, if it's carpeted or tiled, that actually can impact the evaluation of the product that they're looking mm-hmm. at. Even though they have no idea
sure.
that these extraneous factors are a part of it. So this whole aspect of the buying environment you know, it, when you think about this, suddenly there's been a lot of interest in the customer journey, customer experience, which is great. I mean, we've been talking about it for many years and now it's a big thing, but okay. It's very important, but the true customer journey encompasses not just what happens when the customer enters the purchase environment, but rather the journey starts at that first level of awareness.
Mm-hmm.
And the customer is just idly thinking, oh, maybe I need a X. And that's how far back you really need to go to understand how that interest maybe is going to build. And if it does, where are people going to go for more information? Who do they ask, et cetera?
Yeah. And just on external factors, I'm trying to remember the example. I was on my way to buy something in the car, going to buy something, and something happened. I couldn't get to the store to buy it. And I'd made up my mind. I was going to buy it. Might have been a chainsaw. I can't remember. So several $100 purchase on my way to buy it. And I got a phone call or something totally unrelated to buying that item happened, which stopped me going to the store. And after that, inertia set in and I never did go back to buy that one, right? I made mm-hmm. some other alternative. So there's a totally disconnected event that happened. Put me up.
And, I think one good way that online marketers are addressing this, even though we might find it annoying, is sending you a reminder now when you've put something in your cart.
Yep.
Because, the amount of merchandise that people leave in carts, both online and offline in grocery stores, is staggering.
Oh, I've done it. Mm-hmm. I can attest to that.
Entire carts, I don't know the percentage, but it's quite significant, the waste that's left there. And so anything you can do to prompt people is very helpful.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah. And that's, there's some really good people creating abandoned cart follow-up emails now as well, right? That's another tactic that some people are using very successfully. It can be irritating.
Yes.
It's worked on me, I must say. If I abandon a cart and in a little while, I'll get a reminder, hey, did you forget? Hey, we have to remind you that there is. Mm-hmm. Act now and you'll get another 10% off.
Well, I had an experience. Sorry.
Go ahead.
I'm just going to say I had an experience yesterday where I abandoned a cart because I wanted some parts for a piece of equipment that I have. And they were going to come to $49. And then when I proceeded to check out and I calculated shipping, because it was coming from the States to me in Canada, the shipping was going to cost considerably more than the parts. I said, forget it. I'm not doing it.
Yeah, they don't
say. So it just went, no, not until you get it right to the end. Anyway, I may well go back.
Marketers.
I may go back at a later date. So,
many retail chains are increasing security by locking up their merchandise right now. I mean, I was at a dollar store the other day and they even have security guards now at the dollar store. I had to go to a tech company about my cable television and I go to open the door and the door's closed and I had to knock for them to let me in. What impact does this have or will have in the future marketing strategies for brands?
Yeah, that's a tough one. I mean, clearly, we can point to COVID as at least poking the hornet's nest. And I think some of these issues were happening before COVID, but, obviously crime and poverty and desperate people and, the deterioration of some cities. We're seeing it here. I live in Philadelphia. We're definitely seeing retailers picking up and moving out of the center city area. So it's not just vandalism or crime. I think it's the more general issue of will we be shopping in stores down the road. And, I had predicted during COVID, of course, I think I was wrong, but I think the story hasn't been written yet, but I had predicted that we would be moving toward more of a two-tier level of shopping. That is, people who have money can afford to get waited on in stores, and and the rest of us will probably just buy online in many cases. So it's kind of like a high-end department store. Like I know during COVID, Nordstrom was making appointments so that you could go to the store and see a stylist, even though the store itself was not open to the general public. And so this notion of it's kind of like gated communities as income inequality mm-hmm. continues to grow, at least here in the States, I think, unfortunately, we're going to see more of this. And so it does tend to be very frustrating for many people. And we're talking about everyday services. I mean, I live downtown, and I have to walk about a mile and a half to get to the closest pharmacy, believe it or not,
wow.
because they've closed up. So, you know, hopefully this will all turn around and the young people will start moving back into the cities and the wealth will start to flow in. But I think a lot of these routine purchases will migrate online. Probably a good thing. But it's definitely going to be a different environment. And of course, many, as they migrate online, they'll be replacing workers with AI. And so we'll have more and more people who don't have money and need to break into these stores, unfortunately, perhaps. But I hope that won't happen.
Right.
Yeah. It's certainly a concern. Another one, talking retail, and it sort of goes against the trend we've just talked about of stores increasing security. Do you think that automatic cash checkouts, have they reached a zenith? Because I hear a lot of opposition from consumers, particularly my generation, older consumers, who on principle don't want to use an automated checkout. They want to deal with a real person at the checkout. And I was in our local pharmacy chain recently, Shoppers, and there's only one checkout that has a person behind it, and there must have been 10 people in the lineup. And there was one person using the automatic machine. So is that trend of automatic machines going to continue, or do you think it's reached a ceiling?
Well, you know, when you said that, I had a flashback. I want to say maybe it was the 1970s, where they introduced something called an ATM in banks.
Yep.
And a lot of older people were quite resistant, and many banks actually stationed a teller by the machine to help the people use the machine. Now, today, I don't think we see that resistance anymore. So it's tempting to say, yes, you know, and older people tend to be more resistant to innovation. As a rule, there are exceptions. But I think, assuming that technically it doesn't result in a lot of either shoplifting or people being somehow mischarged, and I haven't heard anything much about that. I think the convenience factor will rule the day. Now, there's always a transitional period, and there will always be people who need a checker in the grocery store, just like they need a teller in the bank. But we don't need nearly as many tellers as we used to.
No. That's interesting, yeah. And I was young when ATMs came in. I can remember them being introduced, and it didn't take long, and everybody was using them because it was so much more convenient, even my parents. Yeah, correct. Let's look at another one that can be a huge headache for marketers, and that's boycotts. Now, from my understanding in the past, politically inspired boycotts, and being an ex-South African myself, I'm very aware of it. The ones against South Africa and against Israel, two to think of, were not that effective, right? And they were only really followed by ardent crusaders for those causes. But we've seen recently boycotts of two that I know, major brands, and they've been quite effective, resulting in loss of shareholder value and plummeting sales. And yet the brands seem to be continuing down that road. So is this not a minefield for big brands, that if you get involved in divisive, controversial cultural issues, it might cost you dearly? Where's the clear path on this one? Because I know that many brands want to be considered socially aware, but if you're going to ruin the company in the process, you're not helping anybody, are you?
That's right. Well, I agree. The problem is that there are two minefields. There's the minefield you're talking about, and the minefield if you don't do it. because people are expecting companies to take a stand. They're expecting more out of brands. I've seen data that show that people have more confidence in companies to solve society's problems than they do governments or religious institutions.
Government.
So that puts, you know, a tremendous amount of pressure on the on these brands to do something. Now, the problem is that too many of them are reading the marketing briefings and realizing that they have to do something in this area. Where they tend to get tripped up is that they talk the talk, but they don't walk the walk. You know, so you might have a brand, you know, brand X suddenly comes out and says, oh, you know, we're all about empowering women. And maybe they have a nice commercial about that, but their board of directors is entirely male. And other examples of hypocrisy like that, you know. So I think that many of them feel the pressure to do this, but they're not necessarily aligning their actions with their promotional activities. And so what turns some people off is just this feeling of hypocrisy and insincerity. Because if you have a brand that has a longstanding history of tackling an issue, people are not going to boycott them. You know, no one's going to boycott Patagonia for taking a stand on the environment. They've been doing it for 30 years or whatever.
Right.
But when a company is silent or has even been complicit, you know, it's like Budweiser taking a stand against alcoholism. I mean, come on, you know. And so people, especially younger people, you know, they have very big BS detectors that go off as soon as they hear, especially a corporate message that sounds really stupid. And some of these just sound really stupid. And, you know, it reminds me back in the 80s, and again, I'm dating myself, but some of the big companies were falling all over themselves trying to talk to millennials Generation X and so on, by using their language and, you know, having a guy come on with a baseball cap turned backwards and speaking in 80s lingo, huge failures because the kids at that time said, you know what, this copy was written by a 60-year-old man. This is not real, you know. And so authenticity is probably the single most important attribute that people are looking for today in consumption. Mm-hmm. And that authenticity, part of it is giving back to their share, to their stakeholders, and not just saying that they are. That authenticity is showing that they have a heritage or a history, like many luxury companies can say, or Hewlett Packard can say, here's the garage where we started. Or it's just based on you know, decades of quality. But to come in and suddenly, you know, steal the flag and march to the front of the line and say, yes, this is all about you, I think is a big mistake. It's better to be quiet than to make a fool out of yourself.
Absolutely. Can a brand not be authentically neutral on many issues?
Yeah.
I think a lot of brands shouldn't be. You know, if you make a can opener, I don't see why you have to take a stand on diversity, you know?
No.
Yeah.
Now, on the other hand, you know, if you're in a business where there these issues are pertinent, then you absolutely have to be aware of this. I'm a textbook author. I see it even in the types of photography and ads that we now have available, you know, and I've been writing textbooks for 30 years, and it, you know, for many years, you could never get a picture of anyone but a white male, to put in the book. And, you know, very few women, very few people of color. And so today it's a priority to get more faces out there that look like the people who are looking at them, you know, and that, you know, the audience that, let's say non-white, for example, now we start to see more options. Now that's great. Of course, you can overdo it, like you can overdo anything. But some of these changes are very valuable. The problem is with these freeloaders who think they're going to jump on 20 or 30 years of hard work by a Patagonia and get credit for it. That's
right.
That's really bad.
And I also think one has to look at one's target market. And if 90% of your target market and potential target market thinks like that, then you're really risking trouble if you try and cater for the 10% and overdo it, right?
Yeah, and if you think you're going to persuade someone to change their mind, that probably is not going to happen. You're always preaching to the converted, So as you say, absolutely. It's 90 and 10. It's not going to be 10 and 90 because of your campaign.
No,
you're just going to harden the positions of that of those 90. Yeah.
That's right. So we got a few minutes left. Michael, we're in this post-lockdown, post-pandemic era, and as you've been talking about, online shopping and perhaps two-tier shopping, two-tier purchasing. What other significant trends do you see emerging over the next few years as we come out of this lockdown and looking at what's going on in the world as far as possible recession, high interest rates, huge mm-hmm. changes in jobs? What's your crystal ball telling you for the next few years?
Right. Well, I think, you know, obviously the economy is a huge issue, but who knows what's going to happen there. Mm-hmm. You know, people are moving more to value, you know, like we saw after the recession, the big recession in the 90s, in 2009, rather, 2008, people started to move toward generics as they were getting, you know, to save money. And so the challenge for the brands that do have these meanings is to continue to show how they are providing value to the customer. It may not be financial value, however, getting back to what I've been mm-hmm. saying earlier, there's still a place for brands that are very important to people. You know, even during the recession, I believe sales of pet food did not change. You know, people didn't stop feeding their pets because, you know, or presumably their children, although some would choose their pets over their children, perhaps. But, you know, those fundamental things are still going to apply. And so, you know, I think some of the biggest changes are, I actually wrote a book about this a couple of, that came out during COVID, talking about changes in categories, the categories that we use to create products. Many of those categories are going away. The most obvious one would be play versus work, or home mm-hmm. versus work. You know, it used to be that you did one thing in one place, something in another place. You had a set of products for one and for the other, and ne'er the twain shall meet. But today, here we are sitting on our Zoom call in our homes or what have you. So there are many boundaries or barriers that are going away. Another one is gender. Hugely important. And nobody knows where gender definitions are going to be in 3 years, but they're definitely not going to be where they were 5 years ago. And so as many people start to debate the boundary, you know, what does it mean to be man, woman, male, female, et cetera, that actually has some really interesting ramifications for marketers. You know, one example I like to use, if you're, let's say, in the female accessories business, well, half of the population's male. And as gender definitions start to modify, it becomes more acceptable for males to wear accessories like, let's say, like one of these. And so if I'm in that business, I've been missing 50% of the population, right? So now I can modify my definition of accessories or man bags or shoes or androgynous clothing as one example. And there are others, you know, home furnishing, sure. more men getting involved in decorating the home, even some of them choosing their underwear brand, Peter. But, you know, so fundamental changes, demographic changes, you know, race, we're seeing big changes there, mixed marriages on the increase, ethnic identities fusing together. Lots of interesting ways that society is going to change in terms of defining itself over the next 5 years. And marketers really have to keep up with that, because the brands that they put out there, you know, and again, you put a brand out 3 years ago and it was a big success. You can't rest on your laurels, because there are many examples, you know, in the marketing graveyard of companies that thought they had it, you know, check that box and now sit back and count the money. But things change, society changes, and we're ready for products at different times. You know, for example, back in the 70s, they introduced the first low-cal beer, you know, light beer. It flopped uh-huh. because people at that time didn't know they wanted a light beer. When they brought, that's right. when Miller brought out Miller, you know, Miller Light in the 80s, it was a huge success, particularly among women, because women at that time were now focusing more on wellness and activity and losing weight and so on. So just an isolated example, mm-hmm. but the point mm-hmm. is that you can sure. never rest on your laurels. The only thing we can count on is we can't count on anything. And that's why it's so important to keep your brand fresh and current, not just in terms of functionality, but that engagement factor, which research shows very convincingly has a huge ROI. By some estimates, engaged customers mm-hmm. are responsible for 7 times as much ROI as unengaged customers.
7 times much. Wow, that is incredible. So what about you, in your studies, are you seeing a big change in the effect of reduced family size? I mean, certainly North American women or families of European origin are having fewer children than they did 20 years, 30 years ago. That's not the same with all racial groups, I know. But overall, I think our birth rate is declining. So mm-hmm. what are the long-term effects of that?
Well, you know, you have the midterm and the long-term. You know, the midterm, well, right now, we still have a lot of people living with their parents. You know, the so-called boomerang babies, you know, you throw mm-hmm. them away, they keep coming back. I think in the midterm, that's going to have to shake out as those kids, I say kids, they are 20s and 30s, start to regain their financial footing. Perhaps they're going to start to move. Maybe they're going to start to move back into the cities, et cetera. Some of the bigger builders, though, are, you know, they're looking at multi-generational families mm-hmm. and a new market for multi-generational residences where 3 generations are living in the same house, you know, the mother-in-law basement and that kind of thing. That's starting to come back. And so, you know, anything can happen. Birth rates can change. Although I think, you know, our birth rates aren't going to climb in this part of the world for quite some time. Mm-hmm. So, mm-hmm. You know, it's certainly good for the kids coming out. You know, my students coming out looking for jobs are in much better shape than they were 10 years ago, sure. simply because there's fewer job seekers, if not.
Yeah. All. And there's more of our generation retiring, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
Last quick one, and then I'm sure Kathleen's got something for you. What does the future look like for small town North America? My feeling is that it could be a boon for many small towns that have good internet connection, because people are realizing they can work remotely from a small town and have a much better quality of life if that's what they like than in a small apartment in a big city. Yeah. Is this a trend or is it just an isolated thing?
It seems to be. I personally regret it because I love the vibrancy of large cities.
Sure.
But many people don't. And you know, we're seeing this already. I don't know about small town, but I know that so-called mid-size mm-hmm. cities are really seeing a boom right now. That's where a lot of people are going. So they still want the amenities, you know, they still want some of the culture of that larger place. I don't know if they're willing to move to the outback to be in solitude, but they're definitely going to downsize. And the economics of it are just too attractive. So
sure. You know,
unfortunately, places like where I live in Philadelphia, or certainly San Francisco, feeling the brunt of it right now.
Yes, been reading about that. Yeah,
you know, that's something that's going to have to be addressed.
And Kathleen, you're seeing huge increase in your city of what's a 250,000, 300,000, right?
Absolutely.
You're seeing places booming. Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. You see it in the infrastructure, like the highways and just in general. I mean, there used to be a rush hour. Now it's rush hour all the time. We've seen a huge boom.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, this is, you know, and this is one of the things driving the metaverse, right? Because it does allow you, and I've been working with this stuff for about 15 years and getting a kick out of it now becoming popular. But, you know, with virtual reality and so on, I'm not saying it's a substitute for being in Times Square or anywhere else, but it can come pretty close if you're out in the middle of nowhere to, you know, as these technologies start to come down in price and get into the hands of middle America or middle Canada or what have you. I think we're going to see that, for better or worse, that's going to replace a lot of social interaction. As an old curmudgeon, I'm not real happy about that, but
no, no.
but I don't think the kids care.
No. So, Michael, let's tell our audience how they can get your book. I mean, obviously, we'll put links in the description, but tell our audience what they have to do to get your course and your books.
Yeah, well, there's a link. If you just go to my website, which is michaelsolomon.com, you will see a link there on the first page. If you can't find it, drop me an email or do so anyway, michael@michaelsolomon.com, and I'll be happy to send you a link.
Sure. And for our audio listeners, those links will definitely be in the description on whichever platform you happen to be listening to this show on. So there we go. Thank you, Michael. That's great. And both Kathleen and I have had a look at the course, and it's really comprehensive and really good for someone who wants to get a good grounding in understanding consumer behavior and engaging in effective marketing. So that's just from me. Back to Kathleen.
Thank you so much, Michael, for being with us today. As always, it's been an absolute pleasure. And thank you all so very much for tuning in. We love to hear from you. So please, if you have any suggestions for some expert guests, let us know. All you need to do is to visit us at theyakkingshow.com. And if you're interested in being a guest on the show, all you need to do is visit the site, click on the contacts tab, and you'll find a short application form. We'd love to hear from you. So until next time, take care, everyone. Bye-bye.